Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Well, the overtime presidential election is over, but our discussion is not. We are continuing the discussion we began in the first hour of Mid-Morning, talking about your reaction to last night's speeches by Vice President Al Gore, his concession speech, and President-elect George W. Bush. You might call that his consensus speech, the speech in which he tried to begin the healing of a nation. Now, did both men achieve the tasks in front of them? What were those tasks? We'd like to know what you think. First, however, we're going to turn to Susan McManus. She's a professor of political science at the University of South Florida. We were able to speak to her a couple of times during the 36 days of this election. And now we turn to her on day 37. It's the end, Professor McManus. You're free now.
Well, let me tell you, Florida is more than happy to be off the radar screen of the country.
Well, all right. Now, let's get your reaction to both speeches last night.
Both of them were superb and did exactly what each of these gentlemen needed to do. And I think the fact that they came back to back was really the sort of closing act to a very long show that was a class act.
What did they need to do?
Well, certainly Vice President Gore needed to actually to give his best performance ever, which I believe he did, and to show that he was a statesman. You've heard all the cliches, I'm sure, very gracious, but yet principled and saddened by the fact that he lost. He carried it out very well, but certainly did make a comment about the Supreme Court and his disagreement with the verdict, but life goes on. Really stressed, I think, the sort of roots of American democracy, faith, family, friends, and democracy itself and representing people, and reached out across the aisle, so to speak, to the person that beat him in a very, very distinguished manner.
And what did Governor, now President-elect Bush, have to do last night?
He emphasized an absolutely imperative theme, which is bipartisanship and one of trying to heal wounds and close a wide divide between the parties in the country. He sympathized with how Vice President Gore and his family must have felt. I mean, it couldn't have felt good. It was very moving to see his daughter's tears streaming down their face. I mean, you knew exactly what the family was going through. Bush tried to reach out and say, I understand, because I could easily have been there myself, and just moved the country on. He stressed issues that both candidates had talked about that were important, that the nation has to deal with, and just said he'd give it his best shot. And I think that both of these gentlemen really did do the kind of speech that they needed to do last night.
Now, which man had the harder job, do you think, last night?
I truly think that Vice President Gore had the hardest job.
Really?
I do. I absolutely do. Because you know that in his heart he was dying, in a way. And there had been so much commentary all throughout the last couple of days about what kind of speech he'd give. Would he say the word concession? Would he be bitter? Would he just stop short of saying I lost? He rose above all of that.
Now, Professor, can't you make the argument that he also is a very shrewd politician and knew that he would be ending his political future unless he did exactly what he did last night?
Well, one could say that, but let me tell you, when you listen to a speech, you can tell when it comes from the heart and when it comes from a script.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he wrote it himself for most of it, I think it showed, because it's been my experience. We've had politicians, a close governor's race here in this state. Bob Dole was another example. Al Gore is yet another. That when all is said and done and these people have to give a speech that they themselves articulate, it's much better and much more genuine than when it's done by professional political consultants and speechwriters.
Does Gore now face the irony that his best speech, the one that the tone of which he could have won a campaign on, was the concession speech?
I think that there's an old saying in sports, go out at the top of your game and leave a great impression. And whether he decides to return to politics at some point or to go a different route, maybe a university president or a foundation president or whatever, this kind of speech gives him that entree to any avenue that he chooses to pursue.
Now, I'm intrigued to hear you say that you think that Vice President Gore had the harder task ahead of him, because we were talking in the previous hour to political scientist Charles Franklin and at the University of Wisconsin, and we were talking about how, in fact, there's always a little more drama, there's something a little more compelling about a concession speech, and yet Governor Bush had the task of uniting and healing and beginning all of that with rhetoric. That's
hard.
Well,
I think that's more a task of governance, but it's easier to say that you can, that you're going to try to do things,
mm-hmm.
and than it is to say, well, you know, I'm out of here, basically.
You know, symbolism is obviously important. There was a reason why Governor Bush chose the site he did.
Oh, most definitely. The democratically controlled chamber of the Texas legislature. And, of course, the introduction by the Speaker of the House, a Democrat. I mean, the theme of bipartisanship and the absolute essentiality of reaching across the aisle in Congress and the country at large was a theme that was definitely reinforced by the setting.
One thing that I think struck some was the fact that after a convention that was very carefully scripted and very carefully populated to seem inclusive of different ethnicities, of different races, of different religions, what does it mean that he gave the speech in front of a huge Christmas tree and what looked to be a mostly white audience?
Well, you know, we can always read a lot into that, and I don't know how the selection of the invitation list went, but just from reading the newspaper accounts of it, a lot of it were the elected officials in Texas, and you know, the Christmas tree, I you know, pass on that one.
All right. What about those calls for bipartisanship that we had last night?
Very important, and I think it's critical that the nation got a good look at the fact that bipartisanship means both parties reaching their hand out to the other. It's not a one-way street. And this was a theme that I think Vice President Gore and President-elect Bush together, their speeches together, certainly gave that impression, and it's something that needs to be reinforced, especially, I felt they were talking to members of Congress.
We are talking to Susan McManus. She's a professor of political science at the University of South Florida. We're talking with her about last night's speeches, the concession speech by Vice President Al Gore, and the consensus speech, if you will, of President-elect George W. Bush. We'd like to hear what you have to say about these speeches. Did the men accomplish what they needed to do last night? Did anything particularly strike you? You have your own observations or insights. It's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Now, you were quoted, Professor McManus, in an article a couple of weeks ago about the partisanship of the post-election. You said people are in no mood to compromise. They're digging in their heels. There's no turning back now. So
that was the legal battles, for
mm-hmm.
sure, and we saw that till the bitter end, till the final high court made its last opinion. It was definitely that was the partisan, most intense partisan segment of the whole election.
Now, knowing that, how reflect for a moment on the possibility of reconciliation in the wake of that kind of partisanship?
Well, I think when you move into the legislative chambers, and especially knowing that elections are coming again in 2 years, which I know a lot of people don't want to hear right now. They want to get away from election talk at the moment. But, you know, many, and I don't want to say many, but some Democrats in Congress, for example, represent districts that were, you know, heavily carried by President-elect Bush. And, you know, there is a, we know from political science that people who represent those kind of districts are often, you know, people who are more likely to work with the president or somebody of the opposite party in this situation. So I think that that would be the place where President-elect Bush would look first for coming up with some things that could demonstrate his ability to work across the aisle very quickly. I would also think that he probably is going to take an issue, perhaps prescription drugs, that was such a big issue that both parties agreed was important. Tackle that one first, get it done to show people that that is the way that he's going to govern.
Let's go to Julie. She's calling us from Golden Valley. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Julie.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah.
Well, what one of my observations of this election is that before the election, I don't think the public had a great confidence in Al Gore to be a leader, to be, you know, to step forward, to really be able to do the job. And especially after the impeachment and the problems that President Clinton has had, I think this really has allowed the Democrats to unite and to polarize. And I think they'll be much more of a force rather than splintered like they have been, even though President Clinton's presidency has been a wonderful success. You know,
Julie, you're beginning to break up. I'm very sorry. I need to let you go. But Professor McManus, she made an interesting point about the impact this has had on the Democratic Party.
Certainly in Florida, it has energized Democrats who had somewhat gone into hiding in recent years with the legislature being controlled by Republicans. But it certainly emboldened them, and I think you'll see turnout higher in the next off your midterm election than you have in the past. But I think more importantly what it's going to do in Florida for Democrats is it's going to allow the party to recruit better candidates for particularly state legislative positions. In our state, for example, and this is true in a lot of other places, the party has had to pay attention to the top of the ticket races, like the governor's race or the U.S. Senate seat or the presidential race, and they have really starved, in a sense, the candidates carrying the party's banner in these lower ballot races. But those are extremely important to the building of a party, and there was nothing more evident than the somewhat helplessness of Florida Democrats than when this shifted momentarily, at least, to the Florida legislature, and it became very apparent to everyone that Democrats couldn't stop a thing in either chamber.
Let's go to David in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Morning, Catherine. Morning, Professor. I'm intrigued by the two speeches last night. I did listen to both of them. I have to say, I think they both accomplished largely what they set out to. In fact, I think that when Mr. Bush was speaking, I just can kind of imagine Trent Lott and Tom DeLay bristling a little bit, because if Mr. Bush really means what he was saying, then they're going to be slightly marginalized in some of their efforts of the past. But I want to go to what Professor McManus said about Florida on the radar screen in her lead-in, because I will tell you, there are probably a lot of Floridians that want Florida to remain firmly on the radar screen because of some of the things that are alleged to have happened there. And I think that
David, I'm going to break in here. It turns out that Senator Lieberman is speaking on the Senate floor right now, and we're going to go to him.
Without objection, Senator from Connecticut.
Mr. President, I thank my colleague from New Mexico. I thank him for his customary graciousness as I think about this year and look across the map of the United States and look at the results in the various states. I have even greater love and affection for New Mexico than I did before the year began. Mr. President, you probably noticed that I have that many things in politics and government seem to be taking a little bit longer than normal this year. It is December 14th and the 106th Congress is surprisingly still in session. But happily, that allows me to come to the Senate chamber, this great American forum, which I love and respect so much, and reflect on the extraordinary opportunity Vice President Al Gore gave to me when he asked me to be his running mate this year. Mr. President, when I accepted the nomination of my party at its convention in Los Angeles in August, I began by asking, is America a great country or what? Last night, we ended that remarkable journey in a disappointing way. But nevertheless, I want to answer my question this morning by declaring, yes, America is a great country. And let me offer for my colleagues just a few of the reasons why I feel that way today. Mr. President, in selecting me, a Jewish American, to be his running mate, Vice President Gore did what no presidential candidate before him had done. That required personal courage and confidence in the American people. And today we can look back and say that the Vice President's confidence was totally justified. The fact is that while my faith was the focus of much of the early early media reaction to my candidacy. It was not even mentioned at the end of the campaign. And that is the way we had all hoped it would be. And that's good news, not just for me, but I think for all Americans, because it's a fulfillment of the promise that America makes to its citizens, that in this country, no matter who you are or where you start, you should be able to go as far as your God-given talents and individual determination will take you. The absence of bigotry in this campaign and the fact that the Vice President and I received the second highest number of votes in the history of American national elections should, I think, encourage every parent in this country to dream the biggest dreams for each and every one of their children. Anything is possible for anyone in America. In the 5 weeks since Election Day, because this turned out to be the closest election in American history, our nation's greatness was tested in a different way. But I'm confident that in the end, our election process can only be made stronger by this experience. For one thing, it opened our eyes to some overlooked problems with our system of voting, to the disparities in technologies and practices that may be stopping significant numbers of voters from having their votes counted, and that in particular may be undermining the electoral rights of many poor and minority citizens. Those problems call out for bipartisan investigation and reform. Mr. President, whether you're happy or sad with the results of the 2000 election, I do think that every one of us should be grateful this morning that here in America, we work out our differences not with civil wars, but with spirited elections. We resolve our disputes not through acts of violence, but through the rule of law. And we preserve and protect our system of justice best when we accept its judgments that we disagree with most. This election is over, and I congratulate Governor Bush and Secretary Cheney and wish them well. Mr. President, I had the opportunity to do that personally in a very cordial conversation this morning with the Vice President-elect, Secretary Dick Cheney. As Vice President Gore said eloquently last night, it is time now for all of us to come together in support of these United States and the shared values that have long sustained us. Governor Bush and Secretary Cheney are in my prayers, as I know they are in the prayers of all Americans, as they begin now to assume the awesome responsibilities that go with leadership of this great country. In the strong words and soft voices they both used last night, Vice President Gore and Governor Bush raised us all up and pointed us toward the reconciliation that our history expects and that our national interest now requires. As they both noted last night, this was the closest election we've ever experienced, with the vote for president essentially ending in a tie. The Senate split 50-50, and the House nearly even as well. That puts a special burden, not just on Governor Bush, but on all of us here in Congress, to work on a bipartisan basis and in a cooperative spirit. Mr. President, as I have in the past, I fully intend to work with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle and with President-elect Bush to find that constructive consensus without which we will not help the American people realize their potential. For my family and me, this campaign has been a thrilling and joyful experience. It has deepened the appreciation we have for the goodness of the American people and the love and loyalty we feel for this country. We could not have asked for a more warm, open, and accepting reception as we traveled around this blessed land. We could not have been more impressed with the common sense and strong values that unite our very diverse citizenry. And from their government, it became clear to me over and over again most of the American people, want only a little help every now and then, as they work so hard to make their lives better. And that is exactly what we together should do for them. Mr. President, the most powerful emotion that I feel on this morning after is gratitude. Grateful to be an American. Proud to be an American. Grateful to my wife, Hadassah, my love and my partner, for the devoted support she gave me and the extraordinary way she reached out to everyone she met in this campaign. Grateful to our dear children and mothers and sisters and brothers and relatives and friends whose help and love sustained us. Grateful to Tipper and the Gore children for being such genuine and generous friends, and for the skill and grace with which they conducted themselves in this campaign. Grateful to the Gore-Lieberman campaign staff whose idealism, ability, and hard work make me optimistic about America's future. Grateful to my Senate staff here in Washington and back home in Hartford. They have served with me on behalf of the people of Connecticut for so many years and continue to do so with such commitment during this eventful and unusual year. Grateful to the people of Connecticut whose support over the past 30 years has put me in a position where Al Gore could give me the extraordinary opportunity he did this year. And grateful to the people of Connecticut without whose backing this year I would not now have the privilege of looking forward to 6 more years of service to them and with you, my colleagues, as a United States Senator. My greatest gratitude is to Vice President Gore himself. He has been my friend and colleague for 15 years now, but I've never been prouder of him than I was this year and than I was last night. He conducted the campaign with dignity. He presented his policies and programs with conviction. He spoke with a precision that showed respect for the American people. He stuck to the record, and he worked hard, very hard. Al Gore ran this campaign as he lives his life, with honor, intelligence, and devotion. Today, the Vice President can look back on 24 years of public service with great pride in his accomplishments, and he can look forward to the years ahead with great excitement about the unlimited opportunities that await him. I wish him Godspeed, and I look forward to his continued friendship. Mr. President, the Vice President knows, as I do on this morning, that Psalm 30 assures us that weeping may linger for the night, but in the morning there are shouts of joy. So today, as some of us weep for what could have been, we look to the future with faith that on another morning, joy will surely come. I thank my colleagues in the Senate from both parties for their warm personal wishes and support during the last 5 months. I look forward now to returning to this chamber in January and working with all of you to help improve the lives of the American people and to help elevate their respect for the institutions of our great democracy. Mr. President, I again thank my friend and colleague from New Mexico for yielding me the time. I thank the chair, and I yield the floor.
Senator Joseph Lieberman speaking on the floor of the Senate. This can be said to be his concession speech. We still have with us Susan McManus. She's a professor of political science at the University of South Florida. Professor, any reaction from you on this speech from Joseph Lieberman?
Very eloquent, and I think he stressed a couple of things that are critical to his return to the Senate. Very gracious thanks to all of his colleagues, but I think also a stern point that we need serious electoral reform in this country, and it needs to be bipartisan in nature.
All right, and we're going to get back to a discussion of how that might happen. First, we need to remind you that you're listening to Mid-Morning. We're talking to Susan McManus. We'll continue that conversation. But first, we're going to go to Greta Cunningham, who's been standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. Thanks, Catherine. Good morning. President-elect Bush attended a morning church service in Austin, Texas. It's his first act as president-elect following his victory address last night. Bush is expected to quickly name a White House staff and prospective cabinet. Top billing is expected to go to retired General Colin Powell as Secretary of State. Leaders worldwide are sending messages of congratulations to President-elect Bush. Prime Minister Tony Blair and German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder led the flood of congratulations from Europe with messages of support, also pouring in from Denmark, France, Norway, and Switzerland. Chinese President Jiang Zemin has sent Bush a telegram saying he looks forward to working with him. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak congratulated the president-elect and predicted the new administration would continue with the policy of its predecessors. President Clinton is welcoming the release of U.S. businessman Edwin Pope, who was freed today from a Russian prison. Clinton says Pope's ordeal was unjustified. Pope, who has arrived in Germany, was sentenced last week in Moscow to 20 years on an espionage conviction. Russian President Vladimir Putin pardoned him on humanitarian grounds and to preserve the good relations with Washington. Pope has suffered from a rare form of bone cancer and his family fears it may have returned. Tens of thousands of homes and businesses in Arkansas and Texas are still without electricity following an ice storm. A Central Texas nursing home was forced to take some residents to a nearby church for warmth. In regional news, Northwest Airlines mechanics are raising safety concerns. Their union says they're being forced to work 12 to 16-hour shifts to complete aircraft maintenance and causing an increase in fatigue-related incidents. Northwest says its mechanics are actually working less overtime than usual. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for partly to mostly cloudy skies statewide. There is a chance of light snow or flurries in the west. Highs today ranging from near zero in the northwest to 18 above in the south. At this hour, Duluth reports clear skies, a temperature of 2 below zero. It's zero in Rochester with some mist. St. Cloud reports haze, a temperature of 9 below zero. And in the Twin Cities, cloudy skies, a temperature of 4 below zero. That's a look at the latest news. News programming is made possible in part by membership contributions from listeners like you. If you have not yet made your year 2000 contribution, please call 1-800-227-2811 today. And today's programming is sponsored in part by Larry and Kathy Bogolub, honoring Adelaide Brown on her birthday.
Jazz on a Saturday night. Hello, this is Leigh Cannon inviting you to concerts, to clubs and studio sessions following Garrison Keillor and a Prairie Home Companion. The Jazz Image, Minnesota Public Radio, this Saturday and every Saturday at 7 via KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. Now, we know that many of you were very disappointed on Monday. We were expecting to host an event at the Fitzgerald Theater with author Ellen Gilchrist, a beloved writer of short stories here in this country, and she had to cancel due to weather concerns. Well, you know, there is another event linked to our Talking Volumes book club, and that'll be tonight at the Loft Literary Center. Novelist David Haynes, Granta Magazine, named him, actually also The New Yorker. He's been named by both as one of the rising young literary stars. He, along with senior cultural editor from the Star Tribune, John Habick, will lead a discussion of Ellen Gilchrist's story. So, you know, recoup some of that energy that you had all stored up for Monday. If you love Ellen Gilchrist, if you love talking about books, well, A, you're going to love Talking Volumes, the book club run by the Star Tribune, the Minnesota Public Radio, and the Loft Literary Center, and B, you're going to love tonight. Now go to the Loft at 7 p.m. You need directions, you need more information, take down this number, 612-215-2575. Again, the Loft Literary Center, a discussion on Ellen Gilchrist with novelist David Haynes. Tonight, 7, the Loft, 612-215-2575. Now, meanwhile, we are continuing our conversation with Susan McManus. She's a professor of political science at the University of South Florida. We're talking to her about the two speeches last night and the speech this morning. Senator Joseph Lieberman just gave a speech on the Senate floor. Now, Professor McManus, I'm hoping you can clear up a small detail for me. He kept referring to Mr. President. I'm assuming he was talking to the President of the Senate, but isn't that Al Gore?
You know, I think you're right. And I'm sure that Al Gore was not in there this morning, so perhaps that's just a term that they use to whomever is, presiding.
All right. I was just curious about that.
That's a good question, though. Great question.
Now, right before we had to go to the news, and thank you for your patience, Professor, talk for a minute about the electoral reform that Senator Lieberman was talking about. What do we mean by that when we say electoral reform?
Well, he alluded to the fact that the difference in machinery and the capabilities of the voting machinery itself was so different from one place to another that it had an impact on votes. And we've certainly seen that firsthand in Florida. And frankly, the caller that sort of got cut off, I think I know where he was coming from, and I agree mm-hmm. with him, which is that while I said that we'd like to remain out off the radar screen, I said that pretty much from all the jokes and, Christmas cards we're getting from friends that are making fun of us down here in the Sunshine State. But I think he was saying that certain things need to be kept alive, and one of them is this need for electoral reform. And I think you're going to see it all across the country. And Florida was just the place where it happened, but it could have happened in almost every state in this country. And we need to standardize our election codes to a certain degree, and especially to take a look at getting our voting technology into the 21st century so as to protect the votes of all Americans.
Now, we had some spirited exchanges when we started this conversation in the previous hour with some callers who were suggesting that electoral reform means dumping the electoral college and restoring, but going to the popular vote.
Well, every 4 years we have an intense discussion about reform of the electoral college. Maybe this time it will be a serious and sustained discussion. What we hear quite a bit about, and I think these are things that people are talking about, if, getting rid of the Electoral College, which some people would prefer absolutely, and just go on a popular vote. But that's going to be difficult because of the way that we amend the U.S. Constitution would take approvals from states of extraordinary majorities of states. And that's unlikely that small and medium-sized states are going to go for a total elimination of the Electoral College. But what you might see is more of a move towards the proportional allocation of a state's electoral votes by congressional district and for the two electors that are elected statewide would go popular vote. So I think we're going to see some very good discussion of this issue.
Now, there was some suggestion as well that the intense media coverage on the election in Florida somehow dispelled the attention of the American people on the notion of the popular vote.
Perhaps, but I still hear quite a bit of it. I don't know that I agree with that statement, because just about every newscast that I've heard and just about every major newspaper has had continuous articles about the, this being one of the few elections in American history where the popular person receiving the popular vote did not win, and the person, won through the Electoral College route. So I think it's still very, very prevalent in terms of, foremost on a lot of people's minds, because I give a lot of speeches to every mm-hmm. clubs all around Florida and elsewhere, and repeatedly, I would say there's not a single one that I've given in the post-election period that someone has not asked that question about electoral college reform and then gone back to the popular vote issue.
We're going to go to David in Richfield. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I saw as I was coming to work this morning, I saw a person who was obviously a Bush supporter wearing a button. That caused me to wonder if even she had been listening to all the conciliatory speeches last night, because it seemed to have a deprecatory tone. And the button said, Bush 1, spelled out W-O-N, Gore 0. And so my question is, Gore has made his conciliatory speech and can leave the scene, but George Bush has got to, he's got to persuade his own supporters to share this.
Professor McManus?
Oh, absolutely. And this reaching out of arms and hands across the aisle, it's not just the candidates and it's not just Congress. It does extend down to the American public. But on the other hand, memorabilia and funny and punchy kinds of messages have always been an integral part of American politics, and I don't think it's going to go away. And that's just part of pop culture.
Let's go to John in Plymouth. John, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
I've been listening, actually, you know, like since the election itself, to people talking about how we have to heal the divisiveness in this country and bind up the nation's wounds and so forth. And I just feel like these guys are giving themselves way too much credit for being able to do that much damage to this country. I think back to the late 60s and early 70s, and now that was divisive. That was a nation divided. I haven't seen fathers throwing their sons out of the house over this issue, or confrontations between students and National Guardsmen and so forth. This is a bump in the road, and as far as divisiveness in Congress and so forth, I can think of times when it's been a lot more acrimonious than it is now, and we survive, and I think it's time to just get on with it. And just that desire to get on with it may very well be, you know, the most unifying thing we've got going for us right now, especially based on the things I've heard people saying over the last few days. People that I know are well to the right of Darth Vader had reached the point of saying, I don't care who it is, just get it over with. So I think that's where we're at, you know, rather than dwell on this and try to heal wounds that aren't there. Let's just get on with our business.
Okay, Professor?
Very excellent point. In fact, one of the better comments I've heard throughout these last few days has been, someone said, well, we've gotten over Elon, and we got over impeachment, we got over Monica, we got over OJ, and we'll get through this too. And I think one of the best things that is really happening is that this is finished before a long holiday period, which is often one of the best therapies that we have going, is family and friends, and think about the things that really matter.
We are talking to Susan McManus. She's a professor of political science at the University of South Florida, talking about the three speeches now that we've heard since last night. Of course, Vice President Al Gore gave his concession speech last night, and he was quickly followed by the speech of President-elect George W. Bush, in which he called for reconciliation. Made sure to stress that he was elected to serve not a party but a united nation. And this morning, Senator Joseph Lieberman, Al Gore's running mate, also spoke and talked about the need for some bipartisan work to achieve electoral reform. Well, we'd like to know what you make of these speeches. It's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. Our overtime presidential election is over. Woof. Let us know what you think. 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. All right, Professor McManus, I want you to be really candid here. Isn't there a part of you that's going to miss this?
Yes, and I tell you what it is. It's the excitement that my students now have about politics. It's going to be a hard act to follow next semester. And the good news for my students, because I've been so tied up, is I'm probably going to grade their papers with a little bit easier mark this time around than I did in the past. It's been a great ride. It really has.
We're going to go to Larry in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like most adults have to or should earn their respect before they get it automatically outside the political environment. And I feel that for the president-elect as well. I think that President Clinton attempted to earn respect of the people that didn't vote for him by proposing things that not just benefited his constituency. I mean, he did health care reform, but he also did NAFTA, which really wasn't his constituency. And I think for the president really to be my president as a person who's concerned with the disenfranchised of society, he's going to need to earn that respect by proposing things that benefit the constituencies that didn't vote for him. And until he does, I won't be sure if he is my president or not.
Okay, thanks, Larry. Professor?
A very valid opinion. And, if he is to try to fashion majority votes out of both houses of Congress, he's certainly going to have to reach into some of those very constituencies that did not vote for him, no question about it.
Let's go to David in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
I'm back.
Oh, okay. There you are.
No, actually, I wanted to react just briefly to what Mr. Lieberman was saying, and I'm honored to have been interrupted by him, actually. I think that he said, first of all, a lot of things about Al Gore that Al Gore, of course, was not going to say about himself. And one of the things, when he did mention reform, in the same sentence, he used the word investigation and reform is what he said. And what I was getting at before the interruption was that many of the things that are alleged to have happened in Florida, yes, they are related to the machines themselves in the literal sense, but they're also related to other types of machinery and machinations. There are things that are going to be easy to get over after this election cycle, but there are other things that aren't going to be so easy to get over. If you were a Haitian living in Florida and you had to get to the polls via an encounter with strategically placed state troopers, that's something that's going to be very difficult to get over. And I think that Ms. McManus, frankly, over the course of this process, has given rather short shrift to that kind of thing. And I'm really disappointed that an academic would do that. I'm going to get off because I've already been on too long, but thank you very much.
All right. Any reaction, Professor McManus?
Well, I certainly didn't mean to call short shrift to it. There is no question about it that we have got to look at our whole electoral system as a whole and not just machinery. One of the things that we've learned firsthand is that when we engage in massive registration drives, we also need to help people learn the mechanics of voting. A lot of people made honest mistakes, and it's very frustrating if you're a first-time voter to, you know, mess up your ballot, not know you have recourse. We have to do a better job of educating voters. We also must do a better job of training poll workers to be sensitive and to realize what their real job is, which is to help people vote.
Now, African Americans in particular are quite incensed. I mean, the polling shows, you know, many of them, the majority, it looks like, from according to some polls, that there was not a lot of support in that community for George W. Bush. There is true anger and outrage over what they see as voting irregularities and, in fact, disenfranchisement in Florida. How did George W. Bush reach out to them last night? Wasn't that one of the tasks in front of him last night?
Right, and I believe it's his most difficult task. But let me put things in perspective.
Okay.
African-American turnout in Florida was the highest it has ever been. It went from 10% of the voting population profile on Election Day in 1996 to almost 16% this time around. If it were not for the intense voter turnout, the spike in voter turnout of the African-American community in Florida, Al Gore would not even have been in the contest. It was the most critical and actually the most successful part of the get-out-the-vote effort of the Florida Democratic Party, which expended close to $2 million in encouraging and mobilizing the African-American vote. Yes, we have incidences of where people felt like they were not treated properly and upset about their ballots not counting, perhaps, but the evidence really does show that, and I'm not saying we have a perfect system here, but I think people do not understand that community, above every other community in Florida, had the greatest increase in turnout this election cycle.
We're going to go to Mark in Maple Grove. Mark, welcome to Mid Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I've been hearing a lot of talk about how George W. Bush needs to reach out to the Democrats and work with Democrats. I've not heard one whit of anybody suggesting Democrats need to lay down some of their ideologies and start working with the Republicans.
Well, Professor?
Well, bipartisan is truly a two-way street, and I think that the two speeches juxtaposed next to each other yesterday really did demonstrate that it is a two-way process.
But what is it going to be harder for the Democrats to do that? They've got to be stung a bit.
Well, it's always hard if you've lost, and if you've lost by just the narrowest of margins, and if you don't think you've lost, it is so difficult to you know, lay down whatever. I mean, let's face it, people are people. We all have intense emotions. No one likes their candidate to lose.
What are the chances, really, that we're going to see some bipartisanship?
I believe you will see, depending on the issues selected, and that's why if I were advising George W. Bush, which of course I'm not, but I think that early successes by picking an issue like prescription drugs, which both parties were very close on, actually, with, you know, some differences. But taking an issue like that that's very, very important to all sectors of American society, and particularly the poor and disadvantaged, that's an absolutely essential first step. You've got to show that you can take an issue that has broad-based support and broad-based need.
What sort of honeymoon does President-elect Bush get?
I don't think he gets very much of one. You know, this is going to be the shortest transition ever in American presidency. And it's one thing to pick your cabinet members. It's another thing to get 3,000 to 5,000 appointees in place that you need to hit the ground running for and with to accomplish your agenda. This president's not going to have that advantage. And from the day he takes office, he's going to be under a microscope like I don't think any other president of late has, just due to the unusual circumstances of this election.
Let's go to Steve in Minneapolis. Excuse me. Steve in Waterville. We'll go to you first. Hi.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have a question about the Supreme Court's actions. Long before the election happened, there was the accepted viewpoint that this was an important election because the president would have the opportunity to nominate several Supreme Court justices. Implicit in that understanding is that they are political animals. Why are we now then so angered when they act in a way like, you know, in a political way, as they did?
All right, Professor.
A great question, but I think that if I had to point to one of the things that the average person on the street has learned about our political system this time around that they didn't have a clue about before, it would have to be the ideological leanings of the judiciary, and the way that people are selected to the bench, of course, affect, you know, they're selected often for their ideology. And I think in spite of the fact that in Florida, for example, we have nonpartisan election of our judiciary, because Florida has an Open Records Act, you can, well, the whole world now knows the political party registrations of every member of the bench in Florida. The other thing I think that people didn't realize is that law is often very generally written and not absolutely set in cement and clear as crystal clear. You put those two things together, and Americans have learned a lot about the judiciary, and some of it they don't like.
Let's go to Steve in Minneapolis now. The other Steve.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
hi.
A little earlier you had a caller who compared the election process to a football game, and I just want to touch on that point a little bit more. I thought actually it's a good point to make, because there's a lot of talk about the election process not working or the Electoral College being not working, and I think that it did work. I think that people went into this election, both parties, knowing the rules of the election, just like when we go into a game or any contest, we know what the rules are and we abide by them, and those are the rules that deliver to president. And I think that we need to respect those rules and not go back and try to change them after the fact. And I think that that points to kind of another problem, which is the education of people knowing what the rules are and understanding the process. And I think that is where we really need to have some help, and maybe with the news talking about what the rules of the election are, and also to respect the decision of the lawmakers, the Supreme Court, not pointing immediately to the fact that maybe there's some bias, but to respect that there are reasons for their decision. The last point I just want to make is
quickly,
that maybe we could do a whole show on why the Electoral College does work or doesn't work.
And we've done several of those shows, and I'm sure we'll do them again. Professor McManus?
We do need to educate people about government. This has been the greatest civics lesson that we've had in a long time to excite people. But where much of our system actually starts breaking down is in the high school civics classes across this country, where students are not taught the very basic principles of democracy, nor are they really exposed to the mechanics of voting and the things like being able to move your registration from one place to another, because young people are very mobile. There are a lot of task force across the country on civic education, and I think it's absolutely one of the biggest challenges facing our country.
Let's go to Eric in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Hi.
I think that Vice President Gore's speech last night was another grace note in a long and distinguished career. I'd like to remind people he also gave a graceful and humorous concession speech in 1988 when he withdrew from the presidential primaries after coming in third in a field of seven. And I supported him in 88, 92, 96, and 2000, and I expect to support him in 2004 and 2008.
Okay, thanks. Let's move to Barbara in Rogers. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
As a lawyer, I'm really disappointed in what the Supreme Court did. I felt that there was no real federal jurisdictional question here, and they really reached, and I agree with the dissent of Justice Stevens. And I'm also disappointed that Al Gore has given up the fight and turned his back on the African-American community, which has been disenfranchised. I heard the professor's comment about higher turnout than ever, but that doesn't mitigate against the placement of state troopers. If that, in fact, is true, that needs to be investigated, and that undermines the validity of the entire election, as far as I'm concerned. As far as reaching out, yes, if we're stuck with Bush, I think we have to unite behind him and be patriotic. But I think this election needs to be thoroughly investigated, and particularly those allegations of racial bias, if they, in fact, did occur in Florida. And I'm disappointed that the media hasn't made more of that. The first I heard of it was on page 12 of the Star Tribune. I haven't heard much on NPR or anywhere else about this. Everybody seems to be downplaying the issue.
Barbara, I just want to tell you that Talk of the Nation has done several shows on it. It has been mentioned here. It's out there. But definitely, I think Barbara raises an important point, Professor McManus, which is some have suggested that, as is the case with so many national issues, that there was an African-American presidential election here and there was a white one.
Most definitely. And I think that's the biggest problem facing our country that we need to resolve, and it's going to be very difficult. President Clinton tried vigorously to deal with it, had commissions and whatever. It's just a very, very difficult problem, but we have got to tackle it, and people are sometimes very reticent to talk about it in a very honest fashion.
I want to get quickly, when Eric from Minneapolis called, he talked about, I think he said something about Gore in four, and there were people chanting that last night. Now, how realistic is that?
Well, I've read all kinds of accounts this morning, everywhere from he's assured the nomination to, you know, probably better not try. These are the kind of things that need to settle a bit, but I think that Eric demonstrates the wild enthusiasm that a lot of Gore supporters had for him, and you find the same for Bush. You know, that's a great thing about America. You can get behind a candidate, and you can work for them, and you can support them, and be enthusiastic about them.
All right, Professor McManus, we've run out of time. As always, thank you so much for joining us today.
I enjoyed it. You have excellent listeners.
Thank you. Susan McManus is a professor of political science at the University of South Florida. I'm Catherine Lanfrey. I want to remind you again very quickly, Talking Volumes book club event tonight, 7 p.m. at the Loft in Minneapolis. Novelist David Haynes will be there. Also, John Hobick, senior culture editor from the Star Tribune. You've been wanting to have that discussion on the stories of Ellen Gilchrist. Tonight's the night, 7 p.m. at the Loft. I'm Catherine Lanfrey. You're listening to Minnesota Public